I don't know how much of a secret it may be, but this week on Tuesday, we're having an election. I only know this because I receive reminders, text messages from candidates about every 10 minutes on my phone. It's driving me crazy. But yes, we do. We have a large presidential election coming up on Tuesday, and many would say that our nation is polarized and divided. Some say it's the worst it's ever been. Of course, the folks during the Civil War would argue with that, but it's certainly not good. Polls have shown that a lot of people are just anxious about the upcoming election. But we have to remember that we are blessed to live in a democracy such as ours, where every person has the opportunity to vote. It's not like this around the world. Not every country has this blessing, and it certainly hasn't been like this in our country forever. Black American men only earned the right to vote in 1870. Women got the right to vote in 1920. Thank you, Tennessee. So I've been thinking about the election over, the past 4 years, because that's how long elections now last. Been thinking about the election, but specifically, how do we as Christians comport ourselves during times such as this? How do we live in an election season and be true to our faith? And so I've come up with three questions that I would like to address one at a time and walk through those, and maybe that'll clear the matter up a bit. Probably not. But the first question is deceptively simple. The first question is, should Christians vote? You would think, well, yes. Well, there are many who argue that being a Christian means that one shouldn't vote. That's, as I said, it's deceptively simple question. But some say, no, that as Christians, that we are to be citizens of a different reality, God's reality. We are to live in the kingdom, not on earth. We are not to get involved with the secular political affairs. They're too messy, too dirty. We are to be above these things. They also argue that since God has power over all things, there's really no need to vote. God will decide. On the other hand, there is the argument that Christians should participate in the electoral system. And there are numerous reasons for this. The one that comes to mind, first of all, is Jesus' statement, "Render unto Caesar." Now, he says this in the context of some Pharisees asking him a question. In fact, it's a question designed to trap him because it's almost an impossible question to answer. They hold up a coin that has Caesar's picture on it, and they ask, is it lawful to pay a tax to Caesar? And this is a double-edged sword because it has a secular trap and a theological trap attached to it. On the secular side, the Jews were an occupied people. Rome was the occupying government. And so they objected to paying this rather onerous tax to people they had not elected and did not want to be in charge of them. So was it lawful to support this occupying government by paying your taxes? The other question, part of the question, is theological. Caesar, whose picture is on the coin, viewed himself as being a god, and the Romans viewed the emperor as a god. Now, the Jews said, our God tells us to worship him and only him, to put no other gods before him. And if we are giving money to this other god, are we breaking our commandment to our God? So you can see the questions within the question. And Jesus' answer, he says, give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's. Now remember, on the coin is an image of Caesar. And so he's saying, give to Caesar those things that have his picture on them, his image on them. Money, all right, give the money to Caesar. But give to God those things that have God's image on them. And what has God's image? Us. We are made in God's image. So yes, give to Caesar what needs to be given, but remember that you belong to God. And so from this statement, we deduce that Jesus is in fact giving us the okay to participate in worldly affairs because, well, it's just part of our world. Now, many people have had a lot to say about this issue of whether or not we vote. John Calvin was one of them. John Calvin, one of the heroes of the Reformation, in his 1559 version of his great work, Institutes of the Christian Religion, row of books about this long, he wrote about those who are in civil authority. He calls them the civil magistrates, or the magistrates, we could call them elected officials or politicians even. And he writes about these civil magistrates, "Wherefore no man can doubt that his calling is, in the sight of God, not only sacred and lawful, but the most sacred and by far the most honorable of all stations in mortal life." He's saying that to be a civil magistrate, to represent the people, is indeed a sacred calling. And he goes on to say, with regard to the function of magistrates, the Lord has not only declared that he approves and is pleased with it, but moreover has strongly recommended it to us. So, John Calvin gives his stamp of approval of participating in the electoral realm. Another person I'd like to mention is Martin Luther King Jr. In his essay Letter from a Birmingham Jail, he is highly critical of the moderate white pastors who refuse to oppose racism and injustice with the excuse that, well, these weren't matters of the gospel. They didn't need to concern themselves with them. And King argues strongly that, yes, racism and injustice truly are issues of the gospel that Jesus addressed himself and that all churches needed to get involved in these things. And so here's another person a little more recently who says we as Christians should be involved in the political and social processes. So the first question, should Christians vote? Well, I'll just say yes, I believe they should. Christians should vote as God wills us to be part of this world and not a part from it. So the second question gets a little trickier. Who should Christians vote for? And I will tell you right now, I am not going to tell you who to vote for. That would be, well, first of all, illegal. And second of all, I don't want to. You are all intelligent people, more than capable of making reasoned decisions for yourself, and it's best if we all make our independent decisions about who we vote for. That's how democracy works. It doesn't work if I tell you how to vote. So when we think about the question, who does a Christian vote for? When we're standing in the ballot box and we're looking at the long list of names, we haven't made up our mind, what are the considerations that we should take into account? Well, there are two, I believe. One is character, the other is policy. So with the first, character. Does character matter or does it not? If character matters, then we believe that the candidate that we support should have a good, strong moral and ethical basis, and that the decisions that they make are based on their morals and their ethics. And maybe even they will have a value system that matches my own. That would be good. And it doesn't matter if their morals and ethical decisions are for the good of all or just for me. I want the person to have good character. Other side of the coin, some people say, character doesn't matter. Maybe it doesn't. All they want is for the person just to do their job. It doesn't matter if they lie, cheat, or steal off, you know, on their own, but they just want somebody to do the job. But I got to thinking about it. I can't think of a single job where character doesn't come into play unless you're something like a mafia hitman. So I was thinking about the people that affect my life. I take my car to the tire shop down the street because my brakes are squealing. They take it in. There's a brake technician that's going to work on my car. Now, it's not really an ethical job. There's just somebody doing their job, changing brakes out every day. What does it matter? Well, let's say this person opens a box of new brake pads to put on my car, and he looks at one of them, he goes, this one's defective. I want this person to have the ethical background to say, we need to toss this one out. But I don't want the person that's too lazy and doesn't care, and this is going to stick that defective brake pad on my car and allow me to drive out into traffic, endangering me and my family. Character matters, and we need to vote for the people of good character. The other consideration that we need to take into account is policy. The policies this person approves and votes on and pushes, are they in one's self-interest or for the good of all? Now, some people say, I want the person that's going to do the most for me. In fact, I was watching the national news a couple weeks ago. They were doing a story on the election. They were interviewing people in the street, and this man said, I vote for the candidate that will benefit my wallet the most. I mean, he was right out there purely. It was his self-interest. And that may be okay. If we all voted for our self-interest, it might work in democracy. Or do we want someone that's going to pursue policies that benefit all people or the most people? Or maybe the underprivileged, those who are in distress. Which policies do we want our candidates to pursue? Again, this is a decision that we as Christians have to make. And going back to character, think of the words of Paul writing to the Romans, where he says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So the candidate that we select hopefully is one who will seek out God's will in their work and in their decisions, so that they may do what is good and acceptable and perfect. That's the second question. Who do we vote for? The third, this is the big one. The big question is this. How should we as Christians behave in an electoral season? An electoral season means before the election, during the election, and even after the election. And now that our elections are pretty much 24/7, how do we as Christians behave towards others regarding matters of politics? Now, we know people disagree. What I believe is not what you believe. Disagreement is okay. It's part of the system. It's how our system works. It's based on debate and discussion and hashing out the facts and figuring out what is best for our country, our community, our state. It's important that we disagree, because each time an election comes around, there's campaigning, and we investigate, we evaluate, we validate, we make debate, we formulate, we nominate, and then we vote, hopefully giving a lot of thought to each of these. And there will always be people with different opinions. They will vote for different candidates, different opposing candidates with different beliefs and points of view. And that is okay, as I said, but the question is, how do we choose to disagree? Do we choose to disagree civilly, or do we choose to be uncivil in how we go about it? And if we choose the latter, if we choose to be uncivil, oftentimes that goes down a path that takes us to hatred, demeaning the others, and ultimately dehumanizing the others. Now, a lot of study has been done on this topic of dehumanization, especially in the public sphere. And one scholar writes this. They write, "Dehumanization is the psychological process of demonizing the enemy, of making them seem less than human, and hence not worthy of humane treatment. When we demonize our enemies, we make them less. Demonizing often starts with creating what they call an enemy image. And as we take sides, then we begin to lose trust and we become angry and angrier. And we not only solidify this idea that that person that we disagree with is now our enemy, but we begin to lose our ability to listen, communicate, or even be empathetic towards them. And once we've drawn that line and see people on the other side of a conflict, not as part of a larger discussion, then we begin to look at them as being morally inferior or even dangerous. And now our conflict becomes a matter of good versus evil. We're good, they're evil. And the scholar goes on to say, once the parties have framed the conflict in this way, their positions become more rigid. In some cases, zero-sum thinking develops as parties come to believe that they must either secure their own victory or face defeat. Any chance of compromise is pushed away. And so they seek to punish or destroy their opponent. Throughout history, we have faced dehumanization. It's fueled innumerable acts of violence, human rights violations, war crimes, genocide. It makes slavery and torture possible. Dehumanizing others is the process by which we become accepting of violations against human nature, of against the human spirit, and for many of us, violations against the tenets of our own faith. If we choose to be uncivil in our encounters with those with whom we disagree, we can go down that path. But maybe we can choose to be civil, to listen to those with whom we disagree with love. Never forget that the other is indeed a person like us. And then we seek to understand the points of disagreement, why they see things in the way they do, and seek to learn. And if we can do that, then maybe we can find a middle ground. We can still disagree, but we can respect the other person for their way of thinking, and hopefully they will respect us. Is this easy? No. I love the words of Maya Angelou, who says, "The price is high, the reward is great." It's not easy, but the reward is great. I think we can be guided by the words of the letter of James, which we looked at just a month ago. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger, for your anger does not produce God's righteousness. As Christians in the public sphere, in a time of elections, anger does not produce God's righteousness. So those are the three questions that I've asked. Do we vote? Who do we vote for? But how do we act as Christians in an election season? It's important to remember that we are doing all this because as Christians, yes, we are to vote, but we must also remember to put Christ first in what we do. You all remember, know about the church in Corinth, especially Paul's first letter to that church, and we know that the church in Corinth was just overrun with conflict. There were just too many points of conflict to mention, and Paul tries to address these in his letter. One point of conflict had to do with leadership. See, Paul had come in and founded the church, but then he had moved on, and others had come in behind him with different ways of doing things. And the people in the church were confused. Who do we follow? Do we follow Paul? Or do we follow Apollos, who was an evangelist that came in after Paul? Or do we follow the words of Peter, Cephas, as we call him, the apostle Cephas? Which one? We're confused. Some were baptized by Paul. Some were baptized by Apollos. Some were baptized by someone else who came later. So this conflict in the church arose about who we are to follow. And Paul writes, well, some of you say I belong to Paul. Some say I belong to Apollos. Some say I belong to Cephas. But we really belong to Christ. Christ is our identity. Christ, the others are just civil magistrates, as John Calvin would call them. But Christ is our identity. That is who we are. And so through our words and actions, we are to show Christ to the world. And by doing so, we are demonstrating God's kingdom to the world and spreading the message of Christ far more effectively than almost any other way. Letting them know that we are not here to fight, but we are here to listen. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, we do believe that God is sovereign, that God is completely in control of our world. And I'm reminded of the words again of Paul to Romans, where he says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those authorities that exist have been instituted by God." God is indeed in control. God's will be done. So, the question comes back to our voting. Will our votes usher in the kingdom of God? Probably not. I mean, our votes are just a few in millions. Our votes are important. Please vote. But does one little vote make that big of a difference? But that's not the important thing. It's not about voting or who we vote for, because we're not going to bring in the kingdom that way. It's how we live our lives. Do we live our lives with integrity to the words of Jesus Christ? Do we treat one another with love and respect? Do we love our neighbors? Do we treat others as we want them to treat us? Do we care for those who are in distress, the widows and the orphans, the hungry, the homeless? These are the actions that we must be doing. Not voting, but caring for all people. And if we disagree with them, then let us find the place where we can live together. The book of Revelation is filled with numerous and terrifying images through the first part, but it ends with our reading for today. And it ends with this proclamation of hope. Just as the Bible begins with Genesis, the story of creation, Revelation also ends with creation, but this time it's a new creation. A new creation brought about by God through Jesus Christ. The writer of Revelation says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, coming down out of heaven from God, and I heard a loud voice saying, 'See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them.'" This is the promise of God's kingdom, that God will be with us in this place. And we are to live in such a way that proclaims God to the world. God will wipe away every tear from our eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For those first things, those arguments, those disagreements, the dehumanization, those things have passed away because we choose to live in a new realm. Amen.